Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Americans of all stripes increasingly say our political system is in crisis. They point to intense partisanship, lack of civility, and the inability of government to get things done. Just how bad are things, and how do we get into our current fix? And more importantly, what can we do about it? Today's guest says part of the problem is that we are all hardwired with confirmation bias. We seek out information that confirms what we already believe, and we are far too quick to reject any information that goes against our beliefs and values. Christopher Beam is the managing director of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State. His most recent book is Democratic Humility. Christopher Beam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we talk about the state of politics in America, tell us about the McCourtney Institute for Democracy and your role as managing director.
Well, I just arrived. I've only been here for 3 months, and it was a really appealing opportunity. The McCourtney Institute has established a lot of resources for examining these broad problems of democracy. There's some serious candle power at Penn State, and let's face it, no one, no matter what your political point of view is, no one's thinking that democracy isn't an important and critical issue right now at this time. So the McCourtney Institute is just starting out. It's been around for like 3 years, and my hire is to kind of raise the public profile of the Institute, to increase the resources with regards to engaging the public, serving as a resource for the public, and then also kind of trying to chart a course through these really heady waters, both domestically and also internationally.
As you said, Americans of all stripes, regardless of race, political persuasion, walk of life, they are increasingly saying that our political system is in crisis. From your perspective, just how dire are things?
Well, it's easy to get emotional about this stuff, and it's easy to overstate it, but there's good data out there that shows that people's attitudes, not about politics, not about campaigns, but about democracy as a system, their commitment to that is declining. Now, you know, it's not enormous. You know, you're probably talking about 1 in 5, but that's gone from 1 in 10 10 years ago. So there are reasons to really be concerned about not just how well our democracy is functioning, but how much commitment there is to democracy among the broader body politic.
Well, you say commitment to democracy is declining, and according to a Wall Street Journal and NBC poll, 56% of Americans say that the economic and political systems are stacked against them.
Right.
What complicates that, though, is that Democrats and Republicans see the problem differently. Republicans say that the government is doing too much. Democrats say they're not doing enough. So they're in agreement that the system isn't working. And in fact, 65% are dissatisfied with the system itself. Mm-hmm. And of course, we always say and believe that democracy is the best form of government that's ever been invented.
Right. Right. And then you have people who, no matter where you come down, both parties have moved farther away from the center.
Democrats are more liberal, you
right.
say, and
mm-hmm.
Republicans
mm-hmm.
are more conservative.
And there's just less people occupying the center. And there's lots of reasons for that. Going back to, you know, the civil rights era, that, you know, you used to have Democrats that are far more conservative. But all that means is that there's just less possibility of compromise or even engagement with the other side, let alone a willingness to even find where those solutions might be.
Well, you know, there are even fewer people occupying the middle class. So I have to ask, what impact does inequality have on our dissatisfaction with politics?
Well, it certainly has an impact in terms of people's anger. And you can see that in response to the campaign of Donald Trump, especially. But also, I mean, just about everybody, when I watch the Republican debate, there is a real kind of anger about the status quo. And so how much of that is driven by economics? You know, it's clearly, you know, when you say that the middle class wages or income levels have risen 1, 4, 6, 10% over the course of decades, you can understand where people are frustrated and not understanding, why am I doing this? How is this getting better for me?
What's the state of our day-to-day democracy? And by that, I mean participation in school boards and zoning commission meetings and those sorts of things? Is it in as bad a shape as our political system overall?
You know, I don't know that I could cite data, but I can tell you that the kind of hyper-partisanization that we see in Washington has filtered down to the most assumingly benign political conversations, especially around school board issues. A lot of folks, especially the Republicans did this first, but Democrats are doing it too, they see school boards, county commissioners, things like that as kind of the farm team for future political leaders, future U.S. representatives, for example. And so they're using those seats that used to be like not even contested as being opportunities for pushing their own partisan agenda. So it's the intransigence, the inefficiency of government that we see even the highest levels is also being manifested in some local levels as well.
I think most Americans would agree that we are more partisan today and that there's been a declining standard of political behavior over the past 25 years. Do you agree, and what led to this decline?
Well, you know, there's a number of arguments, but the one that I make in the book is the rise of what I call the partisan infotainment. I think
the new media.
Right. And, you know, I don't see this as some kind of evil cabal or something. I just think it's the market of media responding to this new reality of hundreds of channels and the explosion of social media has made it harder for people to attract an audience. And the way you do that is by filling a niche. And your niche is to be strident, to reinforce the idea that I, the listener, am right and the good guy and the strong American, and anybody who thinks otherwise is at best foolish and benighted and at worst evil.
You mention in your book the FCC's enforcement for 40 years from 1949 until 1987 of the Fairness Doctrine, which required news outlets, the three major networks basically, to present both sides of an issue. That doesn't exist today.
No, it doesn't. But, you know, the Fairness Doctrine is I really want to just identify that as kind of a red herring. It really wasn't all that operative. What was pushing the former model was you had three channels, right?
Right, and, not 100.
Right. And so you had, it's just amazing to me that you had tens of millions of people watching the nightly news, you know, Cronkite or David Brinkley or whoever.
The most
whoever.
Trusted man
right,
in
exactly.
America.
So you had a incentive just in terms of market share to be pretty middle of the road and not partisan. So the same business incentives that were driving media towards a kind of middle of the road, let's let everybody in, is now doing exactly the opposite.
You point out in your book as well that there are today 30 million bloggers. So if you have your set of beliefs and values, there's someone out there who will confirm or validate
right,
for you
right.
that you are right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So these basic features of human beings that all of us have just have an opportunity now that we didn't have 30 years ago to get that kind of confirmation that whatever we think, we're able to kind of surround ourselves, you know, like people call it the media cocoon, where you just, every moment of the day, through tweets, through radio, through TV, through websites, you're able to surround yourself with resources that are going to tell you you're right, the other person's wrong.
You also say in your book, and there's science to back this up, the greater the inconsistency between what we believe and the facts, the harder our brains work to undermine the legitimacy of that information.
Any information that invalidates our belief, if we have an emotional investment in that belief, our brain sees that as a threat, and our brain will work to mitigate or ignore or otherwise decrease the impact of that threat. And so that's not a Democrat thing or a Republican thing. That's a human thing. And there's nothing you can do about it.
And this has been since the beginning of humankind.
Right. There's good evolutionary reasons why we have this. But the brain doesn't distinguish in terms of a threat. If somebody is pulling a knife on you, that's a threat. But if somebody is saying something that undermines something that you hold very dear as a belief or value, that's a threat too. And your brain doesn't distinguish. It's looking for reasons to make that threat go away.
Your book, Democratic Humility, and your argument for what went wrong with American politics and how to fix it, it's based on Niebuhrian arguments, the teachings of Reinhold Niebuhr. Some may know him as the author of the Serenity Prayer, which is used by Alcoholics Anonymous. You call him one of the great political theorists. But for those who have never heard this name, who was Reinhold Niebuhr?
Reinhold Niebuhr was actually, he taught social ethics at the Union Theology Seminary in New York. And he actually called himself a preacher most of the time. That's what he was first. He was a preacher. He had a congregation in Detroit during the Great Depression and right after World War I. And then started doing intellectual work at Union Theological Seminary. And he was always, I think, fair to say, left of center. And, you know, early on, he even ran, I think, for mayor as a socialist in New York long ago. But he is looking at the world through Christian categories. And he was, people called him a Christian realist. So his argument was never partisan exactly, or at least it was never merely partisan. It was always looking at understanding what his obligation was as a Christian toward the state of the world. And that overrode any kind of partisan identity.
So how do you respond to anyone who might question your choice of a far-left socialist as the person to make your case that he can provide the best opportunity to go beyond a politics that is rigid, self-righteous, and in many respects actually mean?
Right. You know, Niebuhr, I mean, there's a lot of things to say to that. Niebuhr was just as harsh, if not harsher, to those on the left. And, you know,
he referred to them as the children of light,
right.
The others as the children of darkness, and was sort of an equal opportunity critic of both.
Precisely. And because he was so identified with the left, he was, you know, harsher towards that side. There's also, you know, if you look, there's just as many folks on the right taking up Niebuhr's arguments and pushing them forward as a good way to understand what's going on as there is on the left. So it's just too easy to say, well, he's on the left. And that actually happens a lot. You hear someone just say, well, I'm not reading that, or I'm not listening to that. But that's just too easy, especially with Niebuhr of all people.
Although you actually say the Democrats are bad, but the Republicans are worse.
Right.
You actually come out and say that in your book.
I do say that. And I also say, given my own political biases, it could be that I'm just misreading this. But there are data that support that point of view. The phrase actually comes from a book by Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein called It's Even Worse Than It Looks. And they're both very well-respected congressional scholars. Tom Mann is from the Brookings Institute, which is kind of left of center. Norm Ornstein is from the AEI, American Enterprise Institute, which is right of center. And so that's where that phrase comes from. But there's also data that show that, especially with respect to media, the Democratic, you know, outlets that are identified as Democratic are bad in terms of using outrage language. But the Republicans do it more. And I also think the Republicans just are better. It's saying things that are that express outrage.
For example, this nation will not survive if that Democrat gets into office, or this nation will not survive if that Republican gets into office. The fate of the planet is at stake.
Right. And it used to be that, you know, when you would say that, or when you get that hyperbolic, you would kind of know that you really didn't mean it, or at least act as if our opponents do get in, it's not going to be the end of the world. But yeah, right now, you know, through the media, the level of rhetoric has been ramped up. And so politicians aren't stupid. They respond to that because they know that's what the audience is expecting. And so the only way to go when you're up is even farther up. And so now you just get more and more outrage and more serious claims about the disaster associated with the other side.
Well, the interesting part about this is, on the one hand, you're using the science and Niebuhrian argument to argue for self-understanding, for self-criticism, and understanding why we think and behave the way we do. And on the other hand, I think you've got talk radio hosts who know that same thing about psychology and human nature, and they're using it not necessarily to convey anything that's truthful or even necessarily something they believe.
Well, who knows if they believe it? I mean, I'm sure that many of them do, and I'm sure that many of them just see this as an opportunity to make a lot of money. But the fact is, it does make a lot of money because there's something very entertaining. You can show on a scan of the brain that your pleasure centers light up when you're hearing something that conforms to what you already believe.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Christopher Beam, Managing Director of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State. His most recent book is Democratic Humility. Beam says if we want to restore our democracy, we need to better understand ourselves and develop some humility when it comes to our beliefs and values. Why is it that we think we are better than we actually are? And science proves this out. We think we are smarter. We think we are more ethical than the facts warrant.
Right. Than any kind of objective accounting of each of us being one of almost 5 billion people on a planet around a sun that's part of a galaxy that's one of hundreds of millions, right? So
we're so significant.
Exactly, right. If there's something about us that's universal, there's got to be a reason for that. And usually it's found in evolutionary theory. And the argument is that if you see yourself as better, if you see yourself as valuable, if you see yourself as important and as your life is meaningful, you're more likely to take on tasks. You're more likely to stick with them longer. You're more likely to respond with energy to a threat, and you're more likely to pass on your genes. So that's why.
In other words, you're more likely to live longer.
Right, exactly.
If you have this positive self-image.
Right.
So we delude ourselves for good reason.
Exactly. That's why we're here. If we have it and we're here, there's a good reason for it.
So why then, if there are good reasons, number one, for having this inflated view of ourselves, and there are good reasons for us to be part of a group, which makes us in a lot of ways less just than if we were operating on our own, why is democratic humility so important to the success of this experiment called democracy?
Right. Well, the way I define the reason I think we need to be humble, it comes from actually a monk, St. Bernard, and he said, humility comes from knowing ourselves as we truly are. And so my argument is not that humility means we need to think less of ourselves. We just need to be more aware of the realities of how we operate, and that should influence how we practice our democracy, how we debate each other, how we argue. And it's not an easy thing, right? I mean, it's contrary to politics. Politics is not a humble enterprise. It's on the contrary.
And you need people to get passionate
right.
and emotional, because if you want them to get behind you and if you want them to support you and send you money,
mm-hmm.
you need to appeal to their perhaps fear.
Right. Right, or anger. I mean, yeah, negative emotions are very, very powerful. I actually, said in the book, nobody goes to the barricades thinking they're pretty sure they're right or that the preponderance of evidence is on their side. They go thinking they're absolutely the good guys and they're going to beat the bad guys, right? So it is not an easy thing to accept or just kind of acknowledge that that's how politics works and still maintain some humility. But it requires kind of schizophrenia, right? I mean, literally, you are going to say, and that's the wrong way to use schizophrenia,
right.
Sorry. But it requires a two-faced kind of thinking, where on the one hand, you are understanding that this is how we have to operate, this kind of emotional level. But at some level, you also understand that you could be wrong, and that the other side probably has a pretty good argument, and that in any case, the other side is probably not evil. They're our opponents. They're not our enemies. And so maintaining that those two thoughts simultaneously is the key to making our democracy work better.
In fact, Niebuhr had a phrase for that. There is good in evil and evil in good.
Yeah, that's straight out of his theology, right? That that we are made in the image of God, but yet we are sinners. And so that manifests itself in politics in the fact that we are never going to get it exactly right. And our motives are never going to be as pure as we think they are. It's just not possible.
You know, I listened to the president's last State of the Union address, and he is a student of Reinhold Niebuhr. And he said something in it to me that was so Niebuhrian, if that's the right pronunciation. He says, imagine if we broke out of these tired old patterns. Imagine if we did something different. Understand, a better politics isn't one where Democrats abandon their agenda or Republicans simply embrace mine. A better politics is where we appeal to each other's basic decency instead of our basest fears.
Right, right. No, I mean, Obama said when he was campaigning that Niebuhr was his favorite philosopher. And I hear it in him all the time. There's actually, there was a speech he gave at Notre Dame when he was commencement speaker. And honestly, if you don't want to read my book, go read that speech because it says the same thing. It's very, very similar point of view.
Niebuhr talks about this idea, and I want to get back to this whole idea of Christianity, because you say in the book that Christianity, and it's funny because so many Americans have moved from organized religion.
Right.
So in some respects, his message may be dated, but that Christianity provides the best hope for a robust democracy, little d,
right,
Democrats.
Right, right, right.
But he talks about religion as profound or profane.
Right.
Explain.
It's a very interesting distinction within Niebuhr, and I was very surprised to see that I haven't seen anybody who's written on this at all, but I think it's really important. A profound religion is one that recognizes that at some fundamental level, God is God and we are not. And we cannot claim to understand God's will. We can try. We can, and we really are kind of obligated to try, but we can't be sure that we're right. And we also have the example of the person that Christians claim to worship being humble, right? Being an exemplar of humility. And so a profound religion is one that affirms all those points. A profane religion is one that says, isn't it wonderful that God happens to think exactly what we do?
Right, right. So the profound allows for self-criticism, and the profane is a source, you know, often of self-righteousness. I am in power because God knows that I'm doing the right thing.
Right.
We're on the same page here.
And that I am doing what God wants me to do, which you can really hope that that's the case, and you should certainly try to make that the case, but you can never be certain that you're right about that. God's ways are God's ways, and our ways are not.
Well, how is that because of the way our brains are hardwired? What does that whole power in God thing, how does it play out for the downtrodden, for someone who isn't in power?
Well,
Are they guilty of the same
things? Sure, because human beings are human beings. And it is our objective to, our inclination to pride is going to make us come up with reasons to say, you know, if I were in power, things would be different. But the fact is, there's nothing in history that shows that to be so. You know, power is a source of corruption, and if you get into it, if you find yourself in a position of power, you will then come to see that this is what God wants, and it doesn't matter what side of the equation you're on. It's a human thing. It's not a class thing or an economic thing.
You also include in your book, Democratic Humility, the work from Diana Mutz about this cross-cutting. These are arguments between people on different sides, but they don't often happen at church or at home. They more often happen in a workplace situation where there's a different decorum in terms of what you respect and how you respond to someone who has a different point of view.
Well, and you can't self-select.
Well,
I mean, that's
true,
a fact. I mean, you know, churches have become, churches, synagogues, mosques, you name it, have become identifiable. Even denominations have become definable by their partisan point of view. So if you don't want to hear it, you just go to the other church. And even neighborhoods. I mean, you know, I know in Chicago and Milwaukee, where, you know, I know far better than Pennsylvania, you can, if you name a suburb, most people can tell you where they come down politically. So you can kind of insulate yourself And it's becoming more and more easy to do that. There's this book called The Big Sort, which kind of speaks to this. But in your employment, you can't make those assumptions. So it is just more likely that that's where those kind of conversations are going to actually happen.
So I guess the big question is, because your book goes way beyond analysis to offer some prescription for how we get ourselves out of this mess, how do we develop democratic humility? And what role does education play in all of that?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's little things that government can do to kind of try to reestablish some of these human bonds between parties. I think there's things that that Christianity especially needs to do in terms of identifying itself not, you know, beyond as something beyond partisanship. And that goes for the right and the left. But I do feel like, or I do say in the book, that the kind of the place that I'm putting most of my chips on is civic education. I think it is established in science that if you explain to people why they are biased, where their bias comes from, and how it is that they can't do anything about it, that it happens both before and beneath consciousness, then that will impact their behavior. And so if you can make civic education not merely the conveyance of information about three branches and checks and balances and the pocket veto and all that, but also teach people this is what happens to you when you're arguing, and this is what you need to do to mitigate those impacts, that could hopefully have an impact on the future of our democracy.
This is why you're doing it, and it goes back to the beginning of mankind, and it has to do with your very survival.
Right, right. And there's nothing, I mean, the one thing I just want to just insist upon is there's no evidence that there's any distinction between Republicans and Democrats with respect to these realities and these behaviors. We all do this.
And it's part of the human condition.
Right. And whereas it's very easy for us to see it in our opponent. It's very difficult for us to see it in ourselves.
So tell us about the role that the McCourtney Institute for Democracy is playing or hopes to play in this 2016 presidential election.
Well, I mean, I do feel like civic education is something that we're very focused on. But for right now, for the campaign, what we would like to do is present a different model, a different way of engaging politically. So we are bringing in speakers who are partisan, who have a point of view, but who are also willing to acknowledge that the other side is not evil or stupid. And so, I mean, it's just to say, you don't have to listen to the Ann Coulters of this world. You know, there are other ways to be a Democrat, small d. You can say, look, this is where I come from. This is what I feel. I'm fairly strongly committed to this. However, I understand that reasonable people can disagree, that you probably have good reasons for supporting your point of view. And now let's argue. Let's not come together and sing kumbaya. Let's argue.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That was scholar and author Christopher Beam, managing director of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State. His most recent book is Democratic Humility. To learn more or to hear other interviews in the Take Note series, check the link on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.